Blog Talk Radio.
Over the last 15 years, our suicide rate has increased 233% among African American children aged 10 to 14. It has increased 133%.
Why? I mean, and that's one of the things. I mean, there was, you know, you could sit around and joke about the fact that there are certain things that black folk will do, but one of them is not kill themselves.
Well, that has changed.
Wow.
And there is not much difference now between homicide and suicide. You know, it's just the lack of value of life that an individual has, okay? I mean, you know, when these kids have shootouts with police, can you imagine that?
No.
That's almost like suicide, because you are not going to win. No way. So that's basically almost like suicide. So we have a lot, so much that we have to deal with. Now, we have basic things that our family structure has to deal with. Paying utility bills. You know, that's a major, major thing. People get depressed every month. You know, you have utility bills, you have doctor bills, you have outstanding women out there that take care of their families every day who are ill and feel that they're all alone. And, you know, they have issues like that they need to get out so they can feel better, because a lot of times your mental issues and emotional issues turn into physical problems. So we have a lot we have to do. There's a lot on the table, and I want to make our community healthy again.
Tonight at Our Common Ground, Black Suicide, A New Reality. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for joining us here at Our Common Ground. I'll be listening for you.
On this wonderful and glorious first fall Saturday of the season. So good to see all and hear from all of you and to have you with us at Our Common Ground tonight. Tonight, my co-host again is Alpha of the Alpha Show, and I want to welcome him and thank him so very much for joining me. You know, Alpha, I feel lost when you're not with me.
That's because I don't know where I'm going.
How are you?
Good evening, Janice, and I'm glad to be here. I want to say hello to Denise Bowles, Greg T, to you two, and, of course, the wonderful India DeClaire. I've got it in our chat.
Oh, we've got India DeClaire in the house tonight. We're going to be talking about a very tough issue tonight here at Our Common Ground, but it is one that we have to get to. And before we do get to it, I do want to acknowledge the passing of the gospel great Albertina Walker on Thursday. And she is now an ancestor. She made her transition, I believe, on Wednesday, Alpha. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about memorial services for her. And also want to wish a very happy, joyous, and grateful birthday wish for Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., who turned 69 this week, and we want to thank him for his service to our community. You know, Alpha, a lot of people don't remember when Jesse Jackson which is absolutely glorious. I mean, when I was in high school, I thought that he was the most handsome giant of a man that I had ever seen. And I really didn't realize that Jesse Jackson is only 9 years my senior, but in the days of his leadership at SCLC and working with Reverend King, and when he first began the Rainbow Push in Chicago, he was just in my mind. You know how you have this idea of a person. He was just a giant of a man.
Well, Janice,
in his younger years, in his early career, he still is. I'm not saying diminishing at all.
Well, Janice, here in Chicago,
who he is
with
and what he's done.
And here in Chicago, a lot of people, you know, it's a hot or cold issue with the Reverend. I've always seen Reverend Jackson as an icon of the struggle of black people. People can call him an opportunist. People can call him what they will, but this is the man who has basically stood his ground and stood in there in the fight. Is he perfect?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. But I would have to say,
are any
he
of them
fought
perfect?
for the black cause when a lot of people were silent, absent, and simply non-existent.
Yeah. You know, I feel that way about Reverend Jackson, and I was his chair for his 1984 run for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and that was just an invigorating and personally empowering experience for me in my lifetime. And it was just a very hopeful. I think that all of the people who supported Reverend Jackson for his run for the presidency, for his nomination, I think that all of us understood that he was not going to be the nominee, that he was not going to be the president of the United States, but that he did stand for all of the principles that we believed in, that he stood, as you've just said, an icon for who we were, that we are here, and we're not going away. So I just wanted to do this birthday shout-out to him. You know, Alpha, we've got to move on, but sometimes we forget and we start marginalizing. Another person that I think of, I'll never forget, when I was a college student, I went down to D.C. to a rally, and the person that was chairing the rally and one of the big speakers was Marion Barry. And to watch him do his work with the crowd, to watch him be powerful in his presentation of the issues of social justice, the issues of racial justice, was something that I can never forget, and it's very difficult for me to convey to younger people. I think that, you know, I had an incident, not an incident, I had a personal experience recently that led me to believe that we have a younger generation of activists, a younger generation of people who take for granted the absolute sacrifices that so many people had so that some of them could benefit. You know, I look at people sitting on being a consultant. If you notice, MSNBC has a new economic consultant. Well, there are so many people who had those skills, who had the knowledge, but were never given the opportunity to use that and had to choose something else. So they made the sacrifices of going through, you know, all the bull crap that in my day, and back in our day, in the old day where you have to stand by and be silent in so many different indignities in order to get what you need and to get what you have to get through. But I think a lot of what I call the Jericho, we were the Moses generation. And the Moses generation, I mean, I always tell people, I can tell you about my journey by showing you and taking you on a tour through the stripes on my back. It wasn't easy. It was not easy. And I think that the Jericho generation takes it for granted and takes us for granted.
Well, Janice, let me add one thing. And it's about the, before we move on, and it's about the Jackson run for president. He garnered enough support to where he was able to change the way delegates were awarded in each state, and that's what brought us President Barack Obama.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. That's right. Absolutely. An organization was already in place. It was in place. People could see the possibility. And I think that we have a responsibility. I mean, I can never forget the sacrifices. Nkechi Taifia sent a note today and said that she's at a conference down in Jackson, Mississippi, and she went to Medgar Evers' home and how the tears flowed from her eyes. In our generation, we did not dismiss. You know, I look at Thurgood Marshall, for instance. If Thurgood Marshall was starting his career after he had made 10 presentations to the Supreme, his legal career, his law practice career, after making 10 presentations to the Supreme Court and being the only lawyer in the country who had never lost in the Supreme Court, he would have been a multi-millionaire lawyer. Not a Johnny Cochran, not a my friend down there in Florida, I can't think of his name right now. You're supposed to be helping me with my memory. But he would have been far surpassed the economic reward of the big lawyers, black lawyers that we know now. But the opportunity was not there for him, and some of that is what the sacrifices were. I too, thank you, Alpha. Want to welcome Dr. Don in our chat room, and for those of you who are listening, if you'd like to join our Common Ground chatters, you can come to www.blogtalkradio.com/OCG, and we have a chat room where people are able to discuss with them our broadcast, the subjects in our broadcast, and we thank them for being with us tonight, and we thank you for being with us. Black suicide, facing the realities, breaking the silence. It was once considered an oxymoron, but it is now an unfortunate reality. No longer an oxymoron, and we mostly don't want to talk about it. We hide it. We hide it inside the pages of our Bibles and Qurans. We hide the suspicion. We hide the worry. And we walk away hoping that my niece, my husband, my daughter, my son really doesn't mean that they want to kill themselves. Before 1965, the suicide rate among blacks was one quarter that of whites. After 1970, suicide rates among blacks had escalated to half of that of whites. In the 38 years since 1965, the suicide rate for black Americans has peaked twice, once in the 1960s and again in the late 1980s. At the same time, suicide rates for African American women have consistently hovered at a rate of 2 per 100,000 of the population. On Friday, October 8th of this year, as the clock tower struck 10 p.m. and the bell rang, the flagpole became the site of prayer and remembrance at Howard University. Students gathered to mourn the loss of Aisha Hassan, who had committed suicide on Tuesday. They also remembered an 18-year-old Rutgers University student who committed suicide after a video of him engaging in sexual activity surfaced on the Internet. They remembered a 13-year-old Hope Witzel, who hung herself from her canopy bed after being bullied by classmates. And they remembered a young African-American teacher who had taken her life, a 24-year-old Ohio State teacher, went to a gun range last week in New Albany, Ohio, and shot and killed herself. That is the face of suicide in the black community. I want to remind you that there are a number of paradoxes of black suicide. It exists in the consideration of how we prevent suicide in the black community, and they require some explanation. Let me give you one example. Black women reject suicide even when they attempt it. Black women are often at the greatest disadvantage in our society. Discrimination, poverty, exposure to violence, intimate partner violence. They currently have the lowest suicide rates in the United States. And you would think also that it would be different, that African-American women's infrequent use of suicide as a solution to their problems would be different. And it puzzles many social scientists. African-American women are just as likely to attempt suicide as other women, but less likely to complete the act. And I think tonight one of the things we want to consider, we want to ask, is what protective factors safeguard black women and how we can transpose that in our community to other things that we need to survive. Okay, here's another one. That this is the second paradox that I found. The black male suicide epidemic turned around in 1998. There was an increase in suicides between 1993 and 1994 in the black male population between the ages of 15 and 24. The increase prompted the United States to declare, our government declared suicide an epidemic among young black males in that year. But by 1998, the young black male suicide epidemic had vanished. The reasons for the 25% decrease in African-American male suicide rate has never been explained. Here's the third one I want to deal with. Suicide rates for incarcerated men are approximately 9 to 15 times higher than for men on the outside, and prison suicide rates are approximately 1.5 times higher than in the general population. Youth in detention and correctional facilities are 4 times more likely to commit suicide than youth in the general population. Now, we all know about the population, the considerate population, the overpopulation of black men in correctional facilities as compared to white men. Nevertheless, of the proportion, white males are the most likely to end their lives in prison. Confinement in prison clearly promotes higher rates of suicide. The dynamic, however, does not appear to affect black males as much as it does white males. I think that we need to have some kind of dialogue about those three paradoxes. The other I want to throw out to our audience tonight, Alpha, is what do people understand as suicide? How do we define it? How do we look at it? And the other is, how do we make, connect the dots from suicide, suicide attempt, to suicide survivors and how that affects our community? Tonight we're going to have joining us in the second hour, Amy Alexander. She is a writer and a producer and a commentator, and her work has appeared in print and broadcast outlets, including The Washington Post, National Public Radio, The Root, and The Nation. She is the co-author of Lay My Burden Down, Unraveling Suicide and the Mental Health Crisis Among African Americans. But here's another question, and we want to throw out all of our questions because we're going to take your calls tonight here at Our Common Ground to hear what your perspectives are about yet another racing, fatal attraction in our community. How much of the abuse of drugs and food, the abuse of alcohol, is really suicidal attempts in our community? How much of the violence, the rage, and the anger we see in the violence, and the self-destruction and black-on-black crime is a part of this whole framework of that we call suicide? How much of sexual promiscuity, sexual misbehavior, sexual misconduct among our youth is really a part of suicide? Alpha, it's really interesting that we as a community have not thought about suicide as a particular other form of genocide. I haven't heard anyone talking about that. Well, I can't get in my chat room. I can't get in my... Alpha, are you still hearing me?
I'm still hearing you.
Okay.
Everyone else?
My browser seems to have frozen, and I can't get into the switchboard.
Well, you're still on.
But I think
the,
that those are pertinent questions.
You're still on the board in the chat room.
Okay. I think those are pertinent questions that we need to raise around this issue of suicide. Now, you've been bugging me all week because you're saying, I don't want to talk about this. Well, part of the problem, part of the outcome that we see may be that nobody wants to talk about suicide.
Well, you know, Janice, I was saying that because I have always grown up with a different perspective on suicide. And I guess it's just the way I was raised. And I look at it as a choice. A choice to whether or not you were going to give in to the bullies, or you were going to give in to the depression, or are you going to give in to the daily fight of discrimination? Are you going to give in? And it takes a stronger person to reject the entire notion. And I've always rejected that notion of harming myself. I've always rejected that notion of disparity, just that desperation and that nowhere else to turn. And if nothing else, just sit there and take deep breaths. But don't go down that road. And the reason I was simply, giving you that I don't want to talk about this, is because my diplomacy would not be in top gear, so therefore I would possibly offend someone, or I would expose my ignorance or my lack of empathy to those who would feel that hopeless, that helpless, either one. And I just have that stance against that final outcome. That, I look upon failed suicides as, just damn. I mean, if the attempt itself has caused you to go down that road, and at some point that doesn't work, then where are you going? So I've always looked at it as a tool of, yes, it's a cry out for help, but the help has to begin with the individual. The help has to begin with the damn it, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going down that road. I can never think of a time when things have gotten so bad that I would want to turn down that road. And that's not saying that everyone is this strong. But I just can't see. I don't care what you are made of or what ilk you are made of. I can't see myself, I can't relate. And
the thing is that I hear what you're saying, and I'm real pleased to have excuse me, I'm real pleased that I don't have a cough button. I'm real pleased to have Amy join with us tonight, because Amy lost her brother to suicide. And to understand suicide, I think that you have to have a better understanding of the kind of deep hopelessness, helplessness, despair. But before we start taking our calls, and our number is 347-838-9852, and we invite your calls, let's look at what suicide is, how it is viewed.
Well, I see suicide as a barometer of a much deeper problem. Not only suicide in terms of completed suicides, but suicide-related behaviors, such as alcohol abuse, drug abuse, sexual promiscuity, road rage, homicide, criminal violence, racism, I think, is a suicide-related behavior. Anytime I do something that's destructive towards me and or destructive towards you or other people, that to me is suicidal behavior. So you can see the problem is very widespread. Now, guilt. Okay? The unresolved guilt, as long as remains unresolved, will eventually become despair. Now, despair, as I said, is a condition of the body, mind, and spirit in which I feel hopeless, I feel helpless, I feel worthless, I feel powerless, I feel unloved, I feel inferior, I feel inadequate, and the other negatives, all right? And so in that condition, and by the way, a condition of despair is also a condition of rage, okay? In that condition, I'm liable to hurt myself even more, and or I'm liable to hurt other people. For example, people who are in a condition of despair, they often will manifest being suicidal. But if a person's in a condition of despair, they are as potentially homicidal and potentially homicidal and suicidal as they are potentially suicidal. We know that females attempt suicide three times more often than males. But males actually commit suicide three to four times more often than females. We know that there seems to be a relationship between depression and suicide. Of course, we also know that females are more often depressed. But what we're just beginning to recognize is that despair or a sense of hopelessness, helplessness and worthlessness and powerlessness is, I believe, a much better predictor of suicide. And then, and therefore then, males, we are more prone to despair, okay? Less prone to depression, but more prone to despair and paranoia. And therefore, we're more prone to actually complete a suicide, whereas females are more prone to attempt. We're more prone to actually complete a suicide.
The act of suicide claims the lives of nearly 32,000 people annually in the United States, and an average of one person every 18 minutes dies by suicide.
Suicide is the 11th leading cause of death in the U.S. By way of comparison, homicide is the 14th.
An estimated 730,000 suicide attempts are made in the U.S. each year. Almost four times as many males as females ages 15 to 19 died by suicide. More than six times as many males as females ages 20 to 24 died by suicide.
Some possible reasons for suicide are depression, suffering, stress, grief, mental illness, family violence, alcohol or drug abuse, financial loss, and loneliness.
More than one person is affected. Each suicide intimately affects at least six other people.
Most suicide attempts are expressions of extreme distress, not harmless bids for attention. A person who appears suicidal should not be left alone and needs immediate mental health treatment. If you know someone that needs help, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Well, that gives us a good framework to work on, Alpho, and our number is 347-838-9852. You're listening to Our Common Ground, and we're looking to break the silence on black suicide. You know, one of the things that is interesting to watch is that when suicide happens in the black community, black families, for reasons of shame, for reasons of keeping secrets about mental health issues and emotional health issues, and even sometimes for insurance purposes, will hide suicide. But one of the things that we want to talk about is suicide is prevalent in our community, yes. But there are many reasons why it is prevalent. If you look at the journey that each one of us takes each day, racial profiling, if you look at our history of oppression and repression, if you look at our economic history for most black people in this country, if you look at what we see. I mean, I think also this whole thing about the American dream may be part of the problem. I think that this whole, we live in a nation where things define people. And when you have a whole group of people who, for the most part, will never have most of those things, then there you have your hopelessness, your helplessness, your yearning to be free if you may. And for those of you who are listening, if you are having problems or suicidal ideation or suicidal thoughts, or you have given consideration to solving problems through suicide, we encourage you to call the National Hopeline Network at 1-800-SUICIDE. In our chat room, we have also provided a link where you can get help in your area. It's www.spsfv.org, and the hotlines from across the country are there. This is a very painful kind of topic, because if you look at the prevalence of our inability to seek help, Alpha, and I want to cover that. Here is a conversation about blacks and therapy, and then we're going to touch on children.
You know, African Americans have never been a community of people who sought out mental health and therapy and counseling. And with our background, you know, coming from slavery, coming through the labor situation and so forth, you know, the wheels are coming off of our machine. Okay? Our background should have had us in therapy and counseling, you know, 50 or more years ago. We have never received it. Our therapy has been the fact that we used to work so hard. You remember, you know, our parents, and you and I are basically the same age. I might have a year or two on you. My dad worked 2 and 3 jobs.
Right.
And that was his therapy.
Right.
Okay? You know, we could always go out and find jobs. And if you remember, you know, we didn't have a lot of crime or anything until Friday and Saturday. You know, now crime is a real big 7-day-a-week job. Anything can happen. But back when we were coming along, our crimes were basically limited, you know, a whole lot to the weekend. But now, you know, now that we've closed down the Firestones, we've closed down the roofing companies, we've closed down all the industries that was our therapy, you know, real problems are beginning to show themselves, because the jobs are not there to keep us busy, to keep us doing something from facing some of the harsh things that have happened to us.
Something that I had never thought about, that many, many years ago you didn't see much police presence in the black community, especially in small southern towns, until Friday and Saturday night, because work was available. And the sense of hopelessness and helplessness and crime didn't come until people in our community started drinking on Friday night. Had you ever thought about that, Alpha?
Well, I see the truth in that, and you're absolutely right, because there was something to occupy, you know, the people. And The lawlessness that took place was basically in that arena involved with alcohol. But you're right, when the jobs seem to have dried up and there's simply, now it's filtered down to our youth. They have no jobs. And to be quite honest, the drug scene has disqualified them for even, you know, being, you know, eligible for a job. So then they're in that abyss, in that, you know, in between. But, you know, Janice, one of the things that struck me that piece pointed out was our we should have been getting counseling over 50, 60 years.
Yeah, we're injured people.
Right, because...
And we just have absorbed injury on top of injury. And one of the things that occurred to me and why I'm being very careful about talking about this subject is that when you look at... Everybody has a TV. You look at the Glenn Beck, and you look at the way in which President Obama has become a target of hatred. You look at the language and the kind of white supremacy and racism that's being articulated openly. Those are more injuries. You know, one of the things that Dick Gregory, and by the way, I had early dinner with Dick Gregory tonight, and he's in Boston. He's at the Wilbur Theater, for those of you who are near, on tomorrow at 4 o'clock. But one of the things that we talked about was that the whole notion that we are always in the business of trying to comfort ourselves. We try to comfort ourselves by giving our children things that we cannot afford, that knocks off our entire budget for the year, sneakers and TVs, 50-inch TVs, and every cable channel on the cable company. And we allow our children to behave in a way which we know is not right, which we know is destructive, but we try to understand. We give them a kind of understanding that our parents never gave us, our community never gave us, because we're constantly trying. If you look at obesity in our community is epidemic among children as well as adults, because we are constantly trying to feed ourselves, to comfort ourselves away from the pain. And people who do not understand that the drugs, the alcohol, the food, you go into any Olive Garden or what's the name of the other place, Applebee's or Popeye's Chicken, and you see the lines of black people who are eating out unhealthy food, and you have to ask yourself, is this a way to make us feel better? Our number, if you want to talk about black suicide, 347-838-9852. I'd like to talk with some of you who have known, who have had to handle a friend or a relative who has been suicidal or expressed suicidal ideation. How would you handle it if Alpha, how would you handle if I call you tomorrow on my and say to you, I don't care about your football. You need to know. I'm really thinking about ending it all. How would you handle that?
If you were to call me during my football games?
I knew you were going to say that.
During my football games. Janice, it's...
I mean, we don't handle it very well.
No,
we don't. We see the signs all the time.
Well, we don't handle it well, Janice, because it's not, to me, it's not, it's not a conscious thing. It's not something that I can fathom. It's not a situation that I can actually sit. I would, of course, I would have to. And Greg, he's right.
Stephen, I know.
And people, he's absolutely right. I'd have to tape as many of them games as I could. But, you know, seriously, many of us simply don't know how to deal with it. Of course, I can be in that, not to let you off the phone and simply try to talk you down or give you reason. Give me the reason that you feel that way. Give me try to make me understand. Help me out with this. Be it whether I would use a technique of anger and telling you, well, damn, what about me? What about my loss? And even possibly going as far as to trick you. If you take your life, I'm going to take mine. Like, that's going to help. But, I mean,
most people say, you just talking.
Exactly.
And the fact is that people are not just talking. It takes, from what I have read, and I had to skim through Amy's book because I have to agree, my friend Alvin Poussant and Amy Alexander, I have not read their book, even though I own the book. I always buy my friend's books. But I skimmed through it after I heard from Amy last night, and I really want to thank Amy because she got my note about this show and offered to come in and talk to us. But most people don't handle it well. Most people give you clues, you know, and I'm sure that there are people out there who have seen the clues. When you see somebody who is depressed, they lose their house. They lose their car. They lose their job. Their wife leaves. I think about that poor man and his house burned down and the firemen just stood around and allowed the house to burn down. The kind of despair he must have felt watching everything he owned. Afia will tell you that there was a blog from a young woman from Boston, and she was scourging on a young woman who was moving in her neighborhood and complaining about people with Section 8 simply because she only saw the woman and the child and made all kinds of assumptions.
I saw that.
These are the signs. I can't imagine that someone would be that angry and that bitter about a poor person that she didn't even know without being in despair and depressed herself. I mean, all of you out there, you all are sitting out there, and I know you have friends who are in deep depression, somebody in this recession, people who get evicted, people who just don't see any way out of trying to take care of their families, to save their sons from the drug corners and the drug dealers, to save their daughters who aren't doing well in school and never go, even though they leave home. Those are all signs, those are all benchmarks of the journey to depression and despair. But we won't say anything. We keep too many we keep too many secrets. We fail to love each other in a way which is honest and direct and open. It is easier for us. What?
I'll say it again.
Say what again?
A lot of everyday people, I mean, that level of recognition of that type of suicidal depression and despair, it just doesn't register. And whether we're willing to admit it or not, we simply don't believe it. And I'm just as anxious to hear our guests, you know, speak on it, because there's a chasm of understanding, a gap for me to get my head around this, for me to, you know,
yeah,
come to that understanding.
Yeah.
I'm just ignorant.
But it really comes to when we step up. You know, one of the reasons that I speak with my mother every day, at least once a day, is because our elders have a especially my mother lives alone. I mean, she has a church, she has a church people, she has a little car, she goes to the Publix, she goes, last week she was with Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and I look in the paper to see, you know, I can't get it to the library, to the senior citizens center yet, because she doesn't like that idea. But we have to be aware. It is not enough for us to know these things. Alpha, we're going to have to go to our phones. I'm sure that Amy's going to be joining us around 11 o'clock, but we're going to go to our phones. Our number is 347-838-9852, and I do want to remind those of you who are listening, if you need help, 1-800-SUICIDE provides access to trained telephone counselors 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Trained counselors, 1-800-SUICIDE. 845, you're on the air. I respect you. Thank you for your call. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Hi, good evening, Janice and Alpha. This is Denise Bowles. How are you?
Hi, Denise.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Denise.
Yes, yes. It's a very serious topic you're talking about here tonight, and I'm glad you're putting light on it. I've owned Amy's book now for several years. I used it as an undergrad in class. And it's very powerful indeed.
Yes, it really is, and I'm looking forward to hearing both her story and her insight into this issue. You know, Denise, I've listened to your show, and this is Denise Bowles, who is also a blog talker. And one of your recent shows, you were talking about kindness. And we were talking about the spirit of kindness, and it always comes down to openness and straightforwardness and having a presence in a relationship.
Yes.
And I think that every person, every black person, has to have a presence in his or her community. I mean, it's just simply not enough to understand the intellectual side of relationships. We have to learn to grow a spirit about the people that we love. I look in the face of our president. I can see some despair. I can see some depression in his eyes, in his face. I go to work, and I know that there are two or three people who are in crisis in my office, and I try to make it a point for them to know that I am an honest, compassionate, and straightforward person. So I don't let, for instance, one of the people who is, you know, like a clerical person, and her husband committed suicide maybe about 5 months ago. I won't let her think that she is alone, and I try to let her know that I understand that as a survivor, she has her own issues. I pass on information to her about how to care for her children who are also survivors. And I think that is the presence that we don't have and need in our community.
Oh, well, you know, Janice, it also takes the presence of oneself. I've been through some very extraordinary times here in the past 2 years myself of being homeless and losing my job. My house was lost to foreclosure. I had a son who was starting his college education and needed everything that I can possibly have to support him on his new journey. And I had basically lost everything and had to restart my entire life. And when you go through something as catastrophic as that and you realize whom your friends are, you realize where your strength is, if you have that strength and where you're going to pull it from. But at the same time, I was a person who had great faith and great spiritual strength. But suicide is also another part of a chemical depression. It's a body's chemical imbalance. There are lack of support systems. There's an isolation technique. It is a systematic process that happens. A lot of times in families, you'll find out that it's actually a family trait where there have been several family members throughout the generations who have committed suicide. So there might be a strain of that in the family based on you know, psychological evaluations. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. for people to get help, people of color to get help, as Dr. Joy Leary so eloquently said it a few months ago here where I live, when a black person goes in for mental health assistance, they first have to calm the white person who's sitting behind the desk down and assure them that they are not in danger, that there's nothing to be fearful of before they can then get services. So it's very challenging for people of color to get services. As a social worker, I can tell you that the DSM-IV, which is the Bible for psychology, is not diverse in its awareness. It does not really go into ethnicity and diversity and understanding. And many times, blacks and Latinos are misdiagnosed. And if we try to incorporate our spiritual beliefs as far as, you know, wearing beads or burning candles or whatever we need to do to get ourselves back up, we're labeled as mm-hmm. being panic or things like that. So there's a lack and a gap of cultural diversity and awareness in the medical profession for mental health care workers to really understand the population they're serving, Janice.
Right. Denise, those are excellent, outstanding, excellent points. And, you know, when people, some of you criticize me when I say that we can't fix our sight on what's happening with the Federal Reserve and what's happening with some of this other stuff, that Wall Street and all this stuff. We have so many issues in our community, and the disparity and the cultural disintelligence of the medical community that services us is one of the issues that we have to be focused on. And the prevention of suicide and the delivery of mental health and somehow eliminating the stigma of seeking mental health and emotional health problems. I am telling you, instead of going to a spa, instead of going to Las Vegas, instead of going to the masseuse, instead of getting your nails done and your toenails done or whatever you get done, whatever luxury you pour on yourself, get a therapist. That's the best thing. And get a good one. As Denise has pointed out, you have to have someone who understands, as Dr. Frances Cress Welsing says, the prickle of our lives.
You don't even have to get a therapist most of the time. You know what you need sometimes, Janice? You need a plain notebook and a pen. And if you've got something on your mind, if you've got tensions built up, if you've got some thoughts that just keep repeating in your head over and over again, write them down in that notebook. Take that notebook when you've had enough stuff in it and burn it. We need to have an action principle behind purging the negativities in our lives. And sometimes if I've had a bad day, I'm just going to sit down and write out everything that really made that day really bad. And then I'm going to ball up that paper that has all that bad stuff on it and throw it in the garbage. It's over. It's done.
Yep. Yep. Denise, I'd love to talk to you more. I want to get to one more call before Amy Alexander joins us.
Absolutely.
Thank you so very much for being with us, and we just love you.
I love you, too. Thank you so much.
Say, I love you, Alpho, to Denise.
Thank you, Denise.
I love you, Alpho.
Thank you. I love you.
Alpho, you, Alpho. See, it took me almost 2 weeks to teach my grandson to stop saying, love ya, to saying, I love you the best. Or, I love you. I mean, there's love ya. Stop your kids from saying, love ya. Make your kids stand and look you in the face and say, I love you. Thank you, Denise.
Thank you.
Love you, Denise.
405, you're on the air. Help me and save me from Alpho. Thank you for your call. I respect you.
I respect you. That's
Hello? Impossible.
Yes, can you hear me?
Pardon me?
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yes, I can.
That's impossible to save you from Alpho.
Thank you, thank you. She doesn't get it yet.
But I'm really interested in this subject matter. I think that I don't know how many of us have been affected by this subject, but we probably know someone who's been affected. I've had it in my family in a couple of tragic situations, and
wow.
I think the gentleman that you had on first talking between themselves, asking the questions and pondering this idea and this thought of taking one's own life hit it on the head pretty much. You know, I mean, back in the day, let me say this, because I can say that since I'm senior, we had to do a lot of physical labor, a lot of work. It was a different era. And a strong body creates a strong mind. And each generation, as I see it, I'm going to put a different perspective on it. I looked in the chat room, and Efia or EIFIA, she put in there, giving up or giving, you know, she had a paradox in there. Don't give, you know, are they giving up or giving out? Are people giving up or giving out? I would say you might give out, but don't give up. You know, let's turn that around. And but we came through a time and a generation in which we were laborers. We worked with our hands mainly. We graduated from high school and we went to work in a factory or some plant. We had jobs like Firestone, GM, slaughterhouses, and we worked hard. Women mainly stayed at home and were educated as teachers, school professionals. Men sort of knew their place back in that time. So we didn't have much time to sit around and get depressed. We had to compete, and we had to put victuals on the table. We had to feed the family, clothe the family. At that time, we didn't live far from one another. We had close-knit families. In the same town, you had your immediate family, your cousins, brothers, sisters, uncles, grandmother, grandpa. Whatever, and so you always
all of it contributes.
So we had a
harmonious unit. There's another aspect to it is as the Dr. Ben Carson said, it is work is with therapy. Also, there's a physical part of that is that when you exercise, when all of your physical organs are working well, it means that it's stimulating your brain, a portion of your brain that fixes, that kind of medicates with a hormone that helps offset. And people didn't have time to eat a lot. I mean, when you eat a lot of food, you think it slows down your body's ability to cope with your problems. I mean, it's all kinds of things. I mean, we eat a lot of carbohydrates, French fries and bread and all of those things keep from the proteins in your body operating in your brain.
Yes, and see, you're talking about work is therapeutic, Denise. And Denise, thank you for your contribution. I really liked what you had to say. But, like, I was working in my gardens this summer. And, you know, I mean, just the sense of getting out in the open country and tilling dirt and planting seed and watering my seed and watch it grow and weeding the gardens that I had. And the time that I put in was a way of me releasing the tension. I was there by myself, no help, just me and my hoe and my trusty guns. And I know you don't like guns, Janice, but you know me. I'm here in Oklahoma, okay? So, and you know who's lived next door. You know my next-door neighbors also,
wild,
right?
Wild West.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I, how do you think I felt last month when I walked out on my property and I looked at my well that I watered my garden with?
It was
with.
Gone. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that where I relieved all of my tension, where I worked and built all of my fences and put them up by myself in my trusty car and a puller, and then to come at the end of the season when they know I'm not there as often every day, I had brought a brand new system to put in, pressure tanks, everything. You know, see, because Denise, mm-hmm. you lost a lot, and I didn't lose as much as you did, but to me that was a loss. I walked out there and nothing there but an open door, and I felt very, very upset and depressed and said, now, what am I going to do? I was angry, very angry, no one to talk to, and so I had to sort of absorb it because I'm used
We've
to.
We've got our guest coming on, Don. I hear you.
You know, I'm a Teflon
and
person. We came up with Teflon on it because we didn't have chance. We didn't have the money, and we did, and it was almost to be labeled. If you went to a therapist, you hardly could do that. You know, that just wasn't our culture. So we came up, Janice, in a way to where we had to sort of take it on the chin, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now this generation
John,
I appreciate
your.
Okay, let me end it then, but I appreciate the program, Janice, and it's a good subject matter. We need to talk about it. The soldiers are committing themselves at an exorbitant rate now, and they're being, when I go to the VA, when I go down there, there's a lot of counseling classes, and it's being emphasized to all of the patients that if they need to talk to somebody, there is an outlet. And I thank you for putting the hotline up there, and it's a good topic, and we need to discuss it more because there's a lot of wounded and hurt people walking around that we need to attend to. Thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don, for your insightful comments. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Amy Lynn Alexander. She's the author of Lay My Burden Down, Unraveling Suicide and the Mental Health Crisis Among African Americans, which she co-authored with my very good and long friend, Dr. Alvin Poussant. She writes and produces news, analysis, and commentary. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post, the National Public Radio, TheRoot.com, and The Nation, and she's working on her next book, Minority Opinion, A Story of Race, Media, and Reinvention, and it should be published in January, or maybe it's already been published, and we'll check with her on that. Thank you all for being with us. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. When we come back, we'll be joined by Amy Alexander.
Suicide is a big problem. As a matter of fact, you might be surprised that based on some statistics that was done in 1995, there were 22,000 murders recorded throughout the nation, but there were 31,000 suicides. And, of course, suicides are usually underreported for obvious reasons, for insurance reasons, and also to avoid the shame that's often associated with a family member killing themselves. Then there are covert suicides. We know that some people precipitate their own death. And so persons who are on the receiving end of a homicidal attack sometimes have set themselves up to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We also know that some car accidents are covert suicide. Mm-hmm. So in terms of accurate statistics on just how big of a problem suicide is, we really don't know, but it's a very big problem in our nation.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for being with us tonight. Black Suicide, a New Reality. Coming up later, here at Our Common Ground, Amy Lynn Alexander. She's the author of Lay My Burden Down, Unraveling Suicide and the Mental Health Crisis Among African Americans, which she co-authored Dr. Alvin Toussaint. Her work has appeared in print and broadcast nationwide, off Washington Post, National Public Radio, TheRoot.com, and The Nation.
He was my best friend, and we did everything together.
I trained him. I encouraged him.
We worked together every day, and we survived some pretty tough times.
We talked about everything. Everything except for what really mattered.
Our team really backed each other up, you know? We took care of our own.
I tried to be there for him in his career.
He said he wanted to die. I thought he was just being dramatic.
I just wasn't there for him in his life.
I wish I'd recognized the warning signs. But I didn't. I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything.
Prevent suicide. Be there. Talk about it. Get involved. U.S. Armed Forces. The courage to care.
I think that we don't know what our pain looks like, what it feels like, what it sounds like. I think far too many of us think that we're the only ones, and we can't dare show a kink in the armor. Meanwhile, everybody that we know, everybody on the planet has holes in them. And you never know how many holes there are in the person next to you. I know that depression is universal. Black people in this country have a whole other set of circumstances that impact on our pain. We either internalize it and we have major illnesses, hypertension, heart disease, cancer, or it comes out. We'll self-medicate with drugs, alcohol, food, and sex. Gambling, working 24/7, and the hurting and the killing each other. 3 years ago, I experienced what was probably the darkest bout of depression I ever experienced. Literally broke down for almost 9 months. And sometimes I would end up at a business meeting and would literally marvel at how I was able to wear that mask that just 2 hours ago I was on the floor in tears. It was not just the pain that I was feeling, it was the stress of pretending that I was fine. I think for so many, we just don't know how to start the conversation. So Black Pain, It Just Looks Like We're Not Hurting, is my expression of faith in the Black community. Let's start the conversation. Then you find out that you're not standing on that ledge by yourself. The ledge concrete, but it's cracking every day because there's so many of us standing on it.
You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for being with us tonight. That was the Our Common Ground friend, Terry Williams, author of Black Pain. It Just Looks Like It Doesn't Hurt. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And we do thank you for being with us here at Our Common Ground tonight. For those of you who are listening and you'd like to join in the rigorous discussion going on about black suicide, you can come to blogtalkradio.com/OCG. I'm Janice Graham, your host, and with me tonight, our co-host, Alpha of the Alpha Show, and you can catch his show at 3 p.m. every Saturday here at Blog Talk Radio. We're joined now by our guest, Amy Alexander. Amy, thank you so much for being with us here tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, it certainly is a real honor. I do have to tell you, Amy, that I bought your book, and I've had it since, I think, before. I always get pre-release books. I order them before they actually come out. Tell us about your story and how you got involved in this whole issue of writing a book about suicide and the mental health crisis.
Sure. I'm hearing some
I'm hearing that too.
Okay. Well, no, it's not back. I'm not sure.
That may be a Blog Talk Radio thing. I don't know if people are hearing it or we're just hearing it.
It seems to stop now. Okay.
Thank you again for being with us.
Oh, sure. It's no problem. Once I wrestled my children into bed, always a challenge on the weekend. They think that, you know,
yes,
all bets are off, you know. But I actually, you know, in my family in Northern California, we had my a situation in which my oldest brother committed suicide. This was in 1979, and it was very 1979. Yes, it was very unexpected, at least to me and my siblings. My mother apparently had, at least probably subconsciously, a inkling that it might come to that. My brother had been masking a mental illness for a long time by using, drugs and this sort of thing, which is not unusual. I learned subsequently a lot of people that have chemical imbalances, in some instances, they will self-medicate, right? So, and I think for African Americans, this probably is somewhat more of a common occurrence because, you know, we have our issues around visiting doctors and getting, you know, sort of regular preventive maintenance, both physically and with our mental health. So in any event, my brother had been struggling with drug abuse for a long time. Ultimately, he got diagnosed as having a mental chemical imbalance. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic. And after probably about 3 years after he was diagnosed, he, you know, continued to struggle and ultimately took his own life. But, you know, I was 10 years younger.
But you were a teenager with your brother
15.
Carl.
Yeah, I was 15 years old, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was a sophomore in high school in San Francisco. It was very shocking and upsetting and... So, as a family unit, we sort of mourned and grieved in that moment. You know, we buried him, and then everything just sort of moved forward. We never talked about it, you know what I mean? It's like we would sort of occasionally say, this would be Carl's birthday. You know, we recognize his birthday every year, but other than that, we never talked about it. None of the issues, you know. And so as I grew up, I mean, I was 15 when that happened, and over the next many years, you know, as I sort of made my way through life and became an adult and, you know, went to college, became a professional, you know, I became a journalist, and it occurred to me as I moved around in news organizations, being a reporter, that I kept seeing in black communities in particular that, you know, there were so many things that reminded me of my brother's situation and that no one was really connecting the dots in terms of, you know, street violence and risky behavior and fatalistic behavior, because this is all a part of, I think, for African Americans and self destructive behavior, it takes variations on the main theme, which is you want to end your own life. Some people do it very slowly. Some people drink themselves to death. Some people, you know, eat themselves to death. You know, that's another thing, death by pork chop, right? A lot of black people who have weight issues, and they know because they're, you know, they know by now that you know, you have to, you cannot continue to eat yourself into the grave, but sometimes they can't stop. So there's a fatalism that happens, and it takes many forms. And I kept seeing this out on the street when I was a reporter in California and then in Miami at the Miami Herald, and then when I moved to New England. And finally, I just reached the point in the late 90s where I thought, you know, I probably should write about this. You know, if nothing else, I should tell my brother's story because it was very tragic and it was very compelling. I mean, he had – the world should have been his oyster, do you know? I mean, he had all manner of resources and a good family that supported him. He had a good job. And still, it ended the way it did. So I approached Alvin Poussant because I knew he was sort of the black psychiatrist, you know, that had been studying this and other black health care issues in general and in mental health topics in particular. So I went to him and asked if he would be interested in sort of guiding me through the clinical research because I didn't, you know, I didn't know where to go for the research. So we talked and he said absolutely. And then it turned out that Dr. Poussant had a brother who essentially killed himself through sort of what's called slow suicide. And I heard your caller previously, you know, talking about veterans, right? And how there's this theme of, well, you know, you're supposed to be stronger. What he was trying to say was, you know, veterans come back and they have this culture where they believe they're supposed to be stronger than the average bear. That's what it amounts to. Well, no one is. You know, everybody needs help at some point. And when you really need help, you really need help. But I think because African Americans, we have this history of having been slaves and having then had to endure Jim Crow and you know, legalized segregation for all these years. You know, so many of us have been conditioned. We've been conditioned. Our parents, our grandparents, their parents were conditioned. You better stand up straight. You better walk the line. Don't look them in the eye and don't cause any damn trouble. So this has sort of, you know, created in us this kind of stoicness that I think in many instances now can work against us because when you really need help, oftentimes you won't reach out, you know.
Because we see the depression as a weakness.
Yeah, because, you
we
know,
see
that's
all
the
signs as weakness.
In our culture,
you know,
that's like the blues. You know, you're supposed to just
right.
sing through it or weep through it or take it to the Lord. You know, Dr. P and I talked about this
yeah.
a lot. We did many
I
chapters.
Let me give you an example of that. We have a very long friend who is really a frat brother and a golf partner in the whole nine yards. And 2 years ago, he had some severe health problems. He has become the most irritable, the most scoundrelous person. His whole personality has changed. He's always complaining about chronic fatigue, and he doesn't ever seem to want to go to the parties or go out to dinner or any of those things, and he's dragging his poor wife behind him in all of this, and she can't explain it. And we were out at dinner a couple of weeks ago, and I said to his wife, do you think he's suicidal? And she was repulsed by my question, and now she won't take my calls.
Yeah, she got her back up.
Because, because of the stigma associated. And
sure.
I tried to explain, I was explaining it to her, and I was being very nice about it. But I thought it should be said because I had already said it at home. He sounds like he's suicidal. Somebody needs to ask him if he's going to go get some help. And nobody is.
Right. Yeah,
so
I mean, it's,
you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That, you know,
it,
people commit,
you know,
slow
and
suicide. They,
yeah, it's a tragedy because, you know, sometimes we can be our own worst enemy, and I don't say that in a kind of political and neocon way. I'm not at all saying, oh, you black people, quit whining and move forward. I'm actually saying the opposite. What I'm saying is that this is really our last frontier. This is the last big hill, one of the last big hills we have to climb. And our progress economically and in terms of education has been well charted. I mean, it's become a cliche to say that, well, there's a black man in the White House, so what are you all complaining about sort of thing, you know, which is a very simplistic kind of fallback message now. But, you know, President
there's
Obama.
There's another way of looking at it, too.
Right.
We're right in the Tea Party are right in our face. The white supremacists have decided to come out.
Oh, yeah, and don't even get me started on, like, the last 2 years. I think first of all, I wrote a piece at the there's a website that the Legal Defense Fund, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund runs called the Defenders Online. And I put a piece up there last September 09, that basically, and I went and I called Dr. P and we talked about this, and I quoted him in the piece, because essentially I think all of America, not just black people, not just white people, we are having a kind of major identity crisis. We are, our psyche is like totally been like just shaken up. In large part, I think it's because of the economic trick that was played on everyone. Everyone except that top 1.5 or 2% of people that basically ran off with all the money, right? Everybody else is like looking like, what happened? Like, I thought I was okay. And well, we're not okay. Financially, everybody got screwed except the very, very rich people, hedge fund managers, the corporation, CEOs. Everybody else got screwed. And that has really, the new normal now is that you've been living on credit. You've been you're overspending. And now the bills come due. Okay, so that's one thing. Second thing is a black president. That is such a historic, it is really, we cannot gainsay how important that is for the American psyche, whether you're black or white or a Hungarian whose family's been here 50 years or a Mexican-American whose family's been in California for, 150 years predating the white people in California. This is a big deal. Okay, that's why now I think we're seeing all this stuff about, well, he's, how come he hasn't fixed all my friends on the left? I know a lot of these hardcore left people in media and politics, and they're all like harshing on the president, and I'm constantly telling them, please settle down. First of all, he's only been in the office for 18 months. Second of all, you need to manage your expectations. If you thought he was going to be the magic Negro and like take a big broom and sweep away all the crap we've been swimming in for the last 8 years, you need to think again, okay? I think in a psychic way, there's a lot going on, okay? So in the context of that, black people, white these white tea partiers, essentially a lot of these people have lost their minds. They have lost their minds. They see that the economic landscape is totally skewed in the favor of rich, the establishment class, the corporate class, has been running things and pocketing all the money. They've been privatizing the money, the profits, and socializing the risk. They don't like that. I don't like it. But then, now there's a black president. So a lot of these white people who never really understood black culture, who don't trust black people, who don't really know black people beyond the stereotypes they see, they're kind of losing their brains now. They're kind of going crazy. So that's happening. Now, for black people, even those of us who are educated, have done everything right, went to the right schools, got jobs, we are now looking at this and saying we are even, to some respect, we have now gone, actually, some of us have slid back 3 and 4 steps financially. I can't tell you here in Greater Washington how many black people I know that are on the edge of it financially. So imagine what's going on in their bodies and in their minds privately right now. Okay, imagine, and I know, I've been through it. Part of my situation was, frankly, a divorce. was when my former husband basically went crazy. He hit middle age and went crazy 3 years ago. That's a whole other issue. But black people now, unless you are somehow miraculously in that very thin layer of financially set people, which most black people are not just because of our history. We don't have wealth. Even if you're middle class, you probably don't have a really good retirement account, okay? That's just the way it is for us because we've not ever really been in a position to have, you know, property and money to just sort of hand down from generation to generation. That doesn't really exist for us, not for most of us, okay? So psychically, there's a lot going on, and I haven't looked into the numbers because I haven't, you know, Dr. Poussaint and I wrote the book about black suicide literally 10 years ago this month. It was published in October of 2000, the hardback, and then the paperback came out the next year. So it's been 10 years. I have not really been following the numbers for about the past 5 years, but I bet you that we are going to see a spike over the coming 5 years in African Americans taking their own lives. When we did the research, we found, and I was shocked by this, that between roughly the early 80s and the mid-90s, the numbers of the rate of increase for black males between the ages of late teens up through the early 30s was just off the, it was like 114% increase. Now, by sheer numbers, it wasn't that big. The largest group that commits suicide every year historically in America for about the past 50 years has been elderly white men. Okay, the next group after elderly white men, the biggest group that commits suicide, is white male young adults, teenagers and young adults. Okay, women are always lowest. Black and white women are the lowest suicide group. But
it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I bet you that you're going to see more African American suicides. I would say across all categories within the next 5 years. In part because of this financial stuff, but also because of this. I mean, I sometimes feel like, well, gee, I'm kind of a loser because, you know, I don't have like a mansion, and what's wrong with me? You know, we got a black president in the White House, and I'm a journalist who no longer really works in journalism because the media industry has tanked. Okay, I've had to move into lobbying. I'm now a lobbyist. I mean, I do communications, but that's what I do now. Okay, other than running my own column on the web, which I write there, but no one pays me. But I've had to bail out of journalism because I've got two kids to support. Do you see?
Well, there are some suicide prevention experts who are speculating in a March study that was published by the Psychiatric Services, a journal of the American Psychiatric Association.
Okay, yeah, update me.
They are saying. That this 105% increase of suicides for black males aged 15 to 19 between 1980 and 1995 is an ugly byproduct of middle class life.
Interesting. Well, you know, France Fanon speculated about that.
In the report, it speculates that as more blacks climb the social and economic ladder, they encounter the same pressures and frustrations as their white middle-class counterparts in the chase for better careers, bigger incomes, and richer lifestyles.
Sure. Right.
So
we've got to
be careful about this American dream thing.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's a piece of it. That is definitely, I think, a piece of it. But I think more acutely, what has been feeding into this or creating these spikes has been our very conditioned. We've got like a real problem with sort of coping mechanisms because of our history in America, we have a propensity to really revert to stoicism, you know. And I think that the middle class, arrival, the ascension into the middle class for many of us has had, to those of us, I think it's almost like a weird generational thing where, and maybe it's geographic too, but like in the past 10 years, I've noticed that among my peer group, and I'm in my mid-40s, there's now a somewhat more openness to seeing a therapist, okay? Whereas when I was growing up in San Francisco, nobody that any of us knew saw a therapist. Do you know what I mean? So that, I think, has changed, and that is a byproduct, I think, also of having, you know, gone to colleges and worked in these workplaces where, you know, you're basically cheek by jowl with people who are always, you know, maybe they're talking about, oh, I saw my therapist. You read about it more.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's become somewhat less of a stigma to reach out in a certain context, though. That's the thing. And I think for people who are maybe not a college educated and who are basically just struggling to keep the lights on and keep food on the table, they barely can see, never mind a psychiatrist or a psychologist, they, you know, they're lucky if they get their teeth cleaned. Do you know what I'm saying? So So there's not the exposure to it. There's not the opportunity. They can't really afford it. Maybe they don't have insurance. And that is combined with, well, you know, why would I go and talk to some person and put my dirty business all out in somebody else's office sort of thing? This mindset is still very much embedded in a lot of us across almost every economic strata, you know, because
you're right.
I'm sure, like the friend you were just describing, the guy, the golf and the frat brother, I'm guessing he got money to see a doctor whenever he needs to see a doctor. That's
exactly.
My guess.
Exactly.
You know,
to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. Our guest tonight in this second hour is Amy Alexander, who is the co-author of Lay My Burden Down, Unraveling Suicide and the Mental Health Crisis Among African Americans. It is a must read. Amy, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk some more about some of the signs. And let me ask you a question. Do you call yourself a survivor?
I guess. I mean, I don't really. I just kind of say I'm someone whose brother committed suicide. I mean, I don't really think of it that way, and there's no political thing about it. I just don't. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I am. So in theory, yes, I am.
Yeah, but you are. And I would imagine, I mean, I'll tell you the story about the suicide in my family that everybody denies and wants to kind of sweep under the rug. You're listening to Our Common Ground. We'll be right back. My co-host tonight is Alpha of the Alpha Show.
How do you wake up the entire African-American community to the hidden issue of mental health?
It showed up in my life through one of my best friends, and we've been friends for over 30 years.
One story at a time.
If we would have known earlier, you know, we would have been much more supportive with her.
Once I reached out to my sister, it got a little better. Once I told my mother, it got a little better. The more I talked about it, I felt it coming off.
The healing is in me, and the healing and the journey can also be extended to others.
It's our community and our mental health.
Giving voice to what you're feeling is part of the healing.
If you're strong enough to just open your mouth, that's all it takes.
And the most revolutionary and healing thing that Black people can do right now is to love one another.
It's time to share ourselves. Healing starts with us. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and the Stay Strong Foundation.
You're listening to Truth Works Network.
Violence against women doesn't discriminate.
Every 15 seconds, a woman in the U.S. becomes a victim of domestic violence.
60% of men who abuse women also
abuse children.
If you or someone you know is a victim of domestic violence,
call Safe Horizon at 1-800-621-4673.
Please call.
You know, Alpha, I figured it out. It's what you've been saying all along.
Finally, our premium level, the Congress!
But this, you had to live in luxury, write laws that benefit your wealthiest contributors, and steal everything you can find till you're indicted.
You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Grand, Alpha of the Alpha Show.
And we do want to thank each and every one of you for being with us out in our listening audience. Tonight, in the second hour, our guest, Amy Alexander, she is a survivor of suicide by a very close sibling when she was a teenager. And I think that one of the things that we do have to talk about is the survivor, how we help our community get through an acknowledged suicide. And sometimes they're not acknowledged. Sometimes they're, I have an uncle who committed suicide more than 40 years ago, and there are people in my family who are still denying that it was a suicide, even though, and family secrets can be really bad because it helps people understand how to put purpose in the love and the nurturing of people that they care about. Amy, can you take a call?
Sure. Yes.
773, you're on the air at Our Common Ground with Amy Alexander, our guest, and Alpha, our co-host. I respect you. Hotep. 773, are you there? Your line's open. 773 must have walked away from the phone. Amy, let's talk about what we can do about prevention and how people really can begin to look at the signs of suicide, especially the signs of what you have described in your book, Lay My Burdens Down, as slow suicide.
Right.
The overeating, there are people who don't go to doctors, and most often we think people are not going to doctors because they just don't want to be bothered, when in fact they are hoping that whatever ails them is going to take them down.
Right. Yeah, even if they're not sort of, the chances are very slim that they would ever articulate it that way, but, that's where the fatalism comes in, right? So you sort of say, well, leave it up to fate, or, it's in God's hands. You hear that a lot, too, among our people. But I think there's a point that needs to be made, which is that there are a set of very universal signs that everyone should watch for, and they are not inherently culturally specific. These include, isolation. If you know someone who has sort of been isolating themselves, if you notice that someone that has had major upheaval in their life, such as, the death of a loved one or loss of a job or, a divorce, or even sometimes a move, like a big move from one residence to another, can trigger in people a kind of a level of pressure that, can instigate other deeper problems. If you notice that someone is drinking or drugging completely, like in a binge, extra, ultra binge fashion. Also, if someone begins to sort of give away their possessions, those are signs that you really need to respond to. And the best tact is to be kind of gentle but firm and very direct. The dancing around is not helpful at that time because it's easy for them to, it's maybe not easy is the best word, but the deflection will happen. You know, oh, no, I'm fine. You know, I was just feeling down a little bit. And, you know, no, I didn't show up at work or at the spot over the last month because whatever, whatever. Well, you kind of need to, you know, position yourself so you can probe, you know, and ask more details. But I think, so those are some sort of universal things across race and culture and everything that are main sort of indicators that someone might be contemplating suicide. But I think the more unique cultural aspects for African Americans tend to be expressed sometimes with extra bravado. I think for young men in particular, if you notice that there is a sort of acceleration in aggressive behavior, and by that I mean that if they feel threatened by a rival or something, if you hear them saying things like, you know, if they're going to roll on me like that, well, we're just going to have to do it, and if it comes out the way it comes out, that's just the way it has to be. You know, that's basically saying, if I got to get shot and die to keep my respect on the street, that's what's going to happen. Okay, that is really bad. Okay, this is what, you know, this bleeds into the neighborhood of suicide by cop, which happens. Victim-precipitated suicide is something that only has become on the radar of specialists in maybe the last 15 years. When we were researching our book in the late 90s, we found maybe 20 cases across the country, maybe 20 or 30 across the country that we could sort of, that Dr. Poussaint felt comfortable speaking of in terms of being victim-precipitated suicide, and probably a quarter of those were black men that would be like in a face-off with a cop, and basically they would essentially say, you know, I'm just going to let this cop kill me, you know. So, you know, it can be a little tricky, and you know, it's sort of like they say when you see someone sleepwalking, you don't ever want to just grab them and shake them. So, I think that kind of applies to someone who's struggling with deep emotional distress and or chemical imbalance. That's another thing. African Americans, you know, we have bipolar or schizophrenia probably at the same rate as any other ethnic population, but we are so poorly diagnosed with this. We are either underdiagnosed or we're overprescribed. Okay, that means
that because we don't have enough coverage or availability of culturally sensitive psychiatrists and psychologists?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, don't even get me started on that. That is, like, shameful. I mean, first of all, there are only, I think, the, you know, out of X number of doctors, I don't know the exact number nationwide at this time, but I think when we did our book 10 years ago, I think the number of black MDs nationwide was only, like, 2 or 3%. And among the MDs, the percentage of those that were psychiatrists was even smaller, obviously. You know, just to be a psychiatrist, you have to be an MD, but to be an MD, you don't have to be a psychiatrist. So, you know, there's a real gap. I mean, in Dr. Poussaint, Carl Bell, you know, there are a handful of African-American psychiatrists and psychologists who have been holding this down for about the last 30 years. And I've been reading, you know, there's some younger people coming up, but you know what? That is a big problem. And some of the medical schools, I know at the University of Wisconsin, I know that at Berkeley, UCSF, for example, there's now a kind of movement happening to build into these medical schools, and at the Harvard Medical School too, because that's where Alvin is. But there's like cultural competency is the watchword. Because you cannot keep training these psychiatrists and these MDs the same way they've been trained for 150 years, which is, oh, gee, black person, you know what? Yeah, fine, whatever. You say you got an ache and misery. You say you kind of got the blues. Well, yeah, fine. You know, take two pills and call me in the morning. You know, I mean, black people have been. It is not an exaggeration to say that black people have been mistreated and/or neglected by the healthcare establishment and the mental health care establishment in America. That is absolutely true. Okay,
and you're right.
And so part of that is because even the few, I mean, Dr. Poussin said, has told me stories about when he was in medical school many years ago, the way the training was so insensitive to the cultural specificity of African Americans and Latinos and Asians. Okay, that's just the way it is. They don't understand our language. They don't understand the way we absorb things, the way we try and cope with a lot of stuff differently than white people do. That has not been built into the training units and mechanisms at these medical schools across the country, and it's a problem.
Right. You know, one of the things is that we have to insist that our community health centers, that our school counselors, that the social workers that work in public social service delivery.
Yeah, but see, that's why
well trained.
Exactly. But when I say this is our last hill to climb, you know, clearly activism and everybody has to advocate for themselves in terms of medical and mental health. Everyone has to do that. But again, think about, I mean, for African Americans, you know, what is, you know, it's sort of like you have to prioritize. And our health care, sadly, has been way down on our list. You know what I mean? And our mental health care has been even farther down on the list. So, yes, more community centers. I mean, look, we were talking about the president in the last segment. You know, I have had conversations here in Washington with people in and around that administration about the mental health thing for people of color. And you know what? It's sort of like something that they're kind of quietly working on, but they will not put it on the front burner because of,
that's right.
You know, it's almost like it's a third rail, because then it falls into this area of, well, we can't just be doing stuff just for the black people. You know, he's the president of everybody. Well, you know what? You know what? And Lester Spence was on NPR the other day talking about this in a slightly different context. But the fact of the matter is, if this administration or any other doesn't begin to pay attention to the health I know the health care bill is a step in the right direction. When that got passed, fine. But the mental health pieces of that, the parity issue and how mental health services are funded and how many community health centers in these communities are funded has got to be more of a priority. It really does. It really does, because people are not going to be, you know, you're just not going to make it. You're not going to make it if you don't have your health.
You're absolutely right. I think there's a universal, there should be a universal concern about the praxis of health delivery in our community. Amy, we only have a few more minutes, and I heard Alpha in the background. I wanted to ask you about your new book coming up, and I wanted to ask you about your community forum where people can join you.
Oh, I know.
But
aren't you? You're very kind. And listen, my book is still in progress, and that my website was put up in the spring of 2009, and I was being very optimistic. But this book has been in progress for 5 years. I'm almost through it now. I've been in very long talks. In fact, Beacon Press, which did the book that Dr. Poussant and I did 10 years ago, is publishing it. God bless them. They've been very patient up there in Boston because, you know, right after I made the arrangement with them back in 2005 to do this book, then I had a domestic situation, so I had to table the work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Beacon has been waiting patiently for this book, and we are now near the end of the sort of heavy lifting part of the editing of it. Literally, you know, it'll be out of my hands at the end of this month and in production So it'll be out next year, okay? Now, my website, and the title of it, I've been thinking, the title of it may change, and I may sort of on Facebook do some sort of polling or something or do something to try and, because I think Minority Opinion, Story of Race, Media, and Reinvention, I like the subtitle now, but I think the word minority is kind of become obsolete, and I think in 10 years it really will be obsolete. So I go ahead.
One of our chatters wanted to let you know that chapter 3 of your book is her absolute favorite.
Of which book? Of the Poussin book?
Of Lay My Burdens Down.
Oh, I don't remember what it is.
Amy, we thank you so much, and we're going to have you back because there are so many issues that undergird the issue of the denial and breaking the silence in our community in talking about these issues.
My pleasure. And media, by the way, media is a big part of it. We didn't even really go there, but it's a big part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have, for those of you in the chat room, I have posted how you can learn more about Amy Alexander, how you can buy her book, how you can connect with her at her community forum. Amy, thank you so very much, and
I look forward
to having you again.
Thank you so much. Take care. I'll see you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was Amy Alexander. You can find her at her community forum, which is part of her website. And she has posted all of her books, and I should mention that she's also the author of the bestseller, 50 Black Women Who Changed America. And we're looking forward to her new book, and we thank you. We thank you all for being with us tonight here at Our Common Ground. This time certainly goes by fast, Alpha. Goes by real fast.
Especially when you're not saying anything. I didn't. Got to get in, but
I told you have to jump in there. You have to get in there. But thank you so much, all of you, for being with us. And Alpha, thank you again for being with us. I think we're going to do some specials this week on this issue of Black suicide. And some of the outcomes and some of the input that causes the problem. I'm Janice Graham. You've been listening to Our Common Ground. You can join us at Facebook. You can join us at ourcommonground-talk.ning.com. And we thank you so much for being with us. We'll be right here next Saturday night at 10 p.m. Look for our notices about what's going to be happening this week. And don't forget, you can check some of the best of audio documentary on Blog Talk Radio at TruthWorks Network. We're going to be doing a segment at TruthWorks this week on Black Wall Street, the Tulsa riots. Good night, Alpha.
Good night, Janice. Love you.
I love that. No. I love you madly.
Thank you for being with us tonight at Our Common Ground, and my thanks on behalf of our audience to Amy Alexander. Don't forget, every Saturday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you, speaking truth to power and ourselves, transforming truth to power. One broadcast at a time. Have a great weekend. Transformative change starts with you, in your mind, in your body, in your spirit, the fuel to change the world.
Wrong.